You're with us on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing legislation to remove the term mental retardation from the state administrative code and the move to replace it with the words intellectual disability. And we're looking at what's behind the legislation and the impact that terminology can have on society and in government. How do you feel about this bill? Do you or a loved one have an intellectual or developmental disability? How do you feel about this proposal? We're at 800-642-1234. Go ahead and email ideas at WPR.org. Representative John Jagler of Watertown is a Republican who represents the 37th Assembly District. He and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald introduced this bill. Representative Jagler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us about how you decided to introduce this legislation. What motivated you to do this now?
Well, it's interesting. There was a bill several years ago that former Representative Eric Severson up from northern Wisconsin had done that replaced mental retardation with intellectual disability. That was way back in, I think, 2010, maybe 2011 he had that bill. And it replaced it in state statute, which is fine, except, you know, as we started reviewing the rules that go with the state statute, the way the legislative process works is we'll write the intent of the legislature, and it goes to the agencies. The agencies then create rules to implement our intent, the law that we passed. And the bill that was from 2011 didn't have that in there. It kind of missed that part. So while the mental retardation still is gone from state statute, it still appears as administrative code, and it still has the effect of law and shows up about 90 times in our law books. And as we were reviewing some of all of the rules, actually, through the last six sessions, or 6 years, rather, last three sessions, we went through all the rules, rule by rule, to eliminate some that were, you know, duplicative and just not necessary anymore. We saw this come up over and over again. I was like, well, you know what, it's got to go. If we removed it from state statute, it's good to remove it from the administrative code as well. So from a consistency basis, it's necessary. For me personally, it has a special meaning. I have a 22-year-old daughter with Down syndrome.
So your daughter Gracie has Down syndrome. How have your personal experiences contributed to wanting to change the official language?
Well, it's more of you know, for me personally, I always at first when Gracie was born, I was always like, it's just a word. You know, people say it; they don't really mean it when they say a retarded. I was like, well, how hurtful can it be, really? But then when, you know, as it moved along and people became more aware that this probably is a phrase that shouldn't be said, it did start to sting a little bit, especially when I had friends or peers my age saying it and in casual conversation, and then they'd catch themselves. That kind of hurt. And for me, it was something that kind of grew on me, but for others, it's a very hurtful phrase and brings back, it's dehumanizing in a way. And it's actually really, really sad, because the phrase mental retardation, clinically, if you just break it down by definition, is not necessarily a bad thing at all. It just means you're slowed mentally. To retard means to slow, and that's what it means. But, of course, it's taken on a whole new connotation and has for years. Started other efforts like spread the word to end the word. And things like that. So in the disability community, it's a phrase that is outdated and hurtful and bothersome to a lot of people. In fact, it was interesting. I've gotten lots of emails from people in the disability community who've reached out to me about this, including from other states that say, hey, well, I wonder if we've done this, we should do this too. But one thing I didn't think of when I did it was a woman who went through and just did her power of attorney and other legal documents because she has a 7-year-old daughter with Down syndrome, and said it was harmful to me when I would look back at those documents that I was signing with the power of attorney, that mental retardation kept on showing up in there. Mentally retarded was over and over in the language. And she said she asked her attorney if she could please strike that out and put something else like intellectual disability that her child has. And the attorney said, no, that would null and void the contract, essentially.
Mm.
So it goes on. It goes beyond, you know, just trying to shame people from saying the R word. For me, it's consistency, but also anything that makes it more, like I said, it's a dehumanizing term.
We're talking with Representative John Jagler. He's a Republican who represents the 37th Assembly District of Wisconsin. We're discussing his bill to remove the term mental retardation from the state administrative code and replace it with intellectual disability. Gathering your thoughts here as well at 800-642-1234. What do you want to ask Representative Jagler about this bill? What do you think about updating the language in the state's legal code? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Representative, is this just the tip of the iceberg here? The Wisconsin Administrative Code is thousands of pages long, and it isn't always necessarily kept up to date with contemporary language. Are there other things in the code that need an update? What's your sense on that?
I don't know. I've heard from some people on the deaf side of it that there were some things in there when it comes to people who are deaf that may be updated. I am not aware of any. Like I said, for me, this was, obviously I have a personal connection to it, but it's also for me trying to make our rules consistent with the statute. So it had a double edge to me, but there may be something out there I certainly would look into. But this bill that Senator Fitzgerald has agreed to have a companion bill in the Senate focuses strictly on mental retardation.
So how will you and Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald move forward on this? Where does it go from here?
Well, the bill went out for co-sponsorship. We had a pretty good response to it on the Republican and Democratic side last week. They were signing on as co-sponsors. Then the Senate Majority Leader will put out his companion bill that will go on. And I just want to thank him publicly because, you know, it's very rare to have the majority leader of the Senate author bills. They may do a couple here or there, but when I asked them and said, hey, this needs to be done, can we, you know, do you think of a Senate author for me to go around and have this on your side of the building? And he said, I'll do it. Let me do it. I'd love to do that bill. So it was great to have his support. From there, it'll be signed and go through the normal committee process, and I can't imagine anybody opposing this. I think it should be fairly quick and fairly easy. Of course, the Capitol's a little different these days.
Yeah, right. let's bring in a really quick call here. Mark in New Berlin. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with you 100%. I just wonder, is either one of the terms defined anywhere medically or legally?
Mark, thanks for the call. And can you go into those definitions?
Well, yes, you can. And the reason why is because in the statute itself, it defines intellectual disability. That was the vehicle that they chose when the original bill to change the statute became law. And this just is consistent with that. So, yes, it is defined, but this would mirror that language from the previous statute.
Well, Representative Jagler, thank you for joining us.
Glad to do it.
Republican Representative John Jagler of Watertown represents the 37th Assembly District. He and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald introduced legislation to remove the phrase mental retardation from Wisconsin Administrative Code. Coming up, we'll talk with a disability rights advocate about this legislation and the weight of words that we use to refer to people with intellectual disabilities. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One in four adults in our country has a disability that impacts major life activities. That's 61 million Americans, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data. We're looking at a bill here in Wisconsin that would remove the terminology mental retardation from the state's administrative code. Let's bring in Barbara Beckert now. She is the Milwaukee Office Director and the Director of External Advocacy for Southeastern Wisconsin for Disability Rights Wisconsin. That is an organization that works to protect the rights of people with disabilities. Barbara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for this opportunity.
For people who do not have an intellectual disability or loved ones with intellectual disabilities, help us explain why the phrase mental retardation is problematic.
Sure. First, I just would like to thank Representative Jagler and Senator Fitzgerald for their leadership, and especially thank Representative Jagler's daughter for her role in inspiring this legislation. So as you mentioned in the previous interview, the word retard is often used as a slang for the term mental retardation. And mental retardation for a long time was used as the medical term for people with intellectual disabilities. And a lot of different terms have historically been used, other terms that we find offensive now, such as idiocy or feeble-mindedness. I think it's representative of the history of people with intellectual disabilities who were often excluded from society, forced into institutions. And we've come a long way since then. People with disabilities in our state are now respected and recognized as our friends and neighbors, our coworkers. And part of that change is recognizing that we need to reevaluate the language that we use.
Your organization does advocacy work for people with intellectual and other disabilities. What kinds of experiences do people with disabilities have with words like retarded or retardation?
Well, as you point out, words have a lot of power, and negative language, such as the use of the term retard, can lead to harmful action and discrimination. One of the areas where our agency does probably the most advocacy is for students with disabilities who have special education needs. And we often see that many of them have experienced bullying and discrimination, and very often that's included being called the R word. That type of language and bullying has major implications. It's not just about being politically correct. It's about treating people with respect and dignity. And students who experience this kind of abuse can act out in other ways as a result of the hurt that they experience. And it can cause some pretty significant problems for them in school.
In particular, why is official language, contracts, or legal code, as we're talking about the language that state government uses, why is that important to get it to change and update and get it right?
Yeah, well, this really brings back some positive memories for me. Back in 2011, as Representative Jagler had mentioned, there was another bill that moved forward to remove the term from the state law. And I was actually at the bill signing, which was held here in Milwaukee in Independence First. And there were so many self-advocates there, individuals who have an intellectual disability, and their families, and many of them had advocated for this change because that language was offensive and hurtful to them. And it was so, it was such a joyous day, and it was so meaningful to be there with individuals whose lives were impacted by this change and who felt respected and recognized. When I looked over the administrative code, I noted that many of the references relate to facilities such as nursing homes or other types of institutions where individuals with intellectual disabilities may live. And that kind of language might be seen, for example, by certified nursing assistants or other staff who are providing care there. So I think having language that is more respectful sends not only an important message to individuals with intellectual disabilities, but those who provide care.
We're talking with Barbara Beckert. She is with Disability Rights Wisconsin. We're talking about how two state lawmakers are pushing a bill to remove the phrase mental retardation from state administrative code. Gathering your thoughts, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Are there other parts of the code you think that need addressing? Do you or a loved one have an intellectual disability? Have you seen terminology not staying up to date? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara, Steve Calden couldn't stay with us. He's asked, there are words that used to be appropriate and are now not appropriate. Aren't the words we now use that are appropriate just going to be problems down the road? What has history shown about how language changes and why is it important to change?
Yeah, well, I thank Steve for calling in, and I think that that's a great point. Yes, absolutely, language does change and evolve, and I mentioned when we started our conversation about historically that other kinds of terms that had been used for individuals with disabilities are now things that, you know, we would not think of using, you know, that are clearly offensive, like idiocy and feeble-mindedness, and we often try and focus on using people-first language to focus on the person and not the disability. And, you know, I've heard people question the use of the word disability, for example. We want to focus on the person's ability to put that first. So, you know, I agree that language continues to change and evolve, and I really respect the voices and perspective of those who have a disability in leading that change. I think that's been one of the striking things in this case. There's been a campaign to end the R word, and it's been led by Special Olympics, which, as you probably know, is an organization made up of athletes who have a disability. So I want to thank them for their leadership, and I've learned a lot from their stories.
Well, here's a big, broad question coming up. How is Wisconsin doing with the way it treats people with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. So I think that Wisconsin is, like the rest of our country, it's a work in progress. I think that we can feel good about some of the progress we have made. In our state, for example, we have an entitlement under family care and IRIS for individuals who have an intellectual disability to have the right to receive services and supports in the community rather than in an institution. So in that respect, we've come a long way towards promoting inclusion. But we still have a long way to go. One of the proposals that we are supportive and we hope Governor Evers will advance in the state budget is to provide that same right for children with intellectual disabilities and other disabilities to not have to languish on a waiting list for service, but to have the right to receive community services and support. Sometimes families end up having to give up custody of a child because they can't get the services that they need. You know, that's wrong. We need to change that.
Barbara, when we are using terminology and addressing someone with some type of challenge, and we may not even know what challenge it is, how do we know about how to go about the language and where we ask for help?
I think that that is a very sensitive and insightful question, and one that we all need to ask ourselves. And, you know, sometimes I think that the best thing to do is to ask the individual and to get their response, because there's not one answer to that question. I think another resource is to reach out to the disability community. There are a lot of groups that are eager to act as a resource. For example, I serve on the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. They have they do a great job of education, always willing to help provide a speaker, do outreach. Our agency, Disability Rights Wisconsin, as well, is eager to provide education and training And there's quite a bit of information on social media as well. So those are a few ideas. The Wisconsin ARC is another group that is a great resource and active on this issue. And, of course, I had mentioned Special Olympics as well.
Barbara, in the last few seconds we have, is this bill a movement or a step toward something else that you're really wanting to work on and move toward?
Well, I think that this bill is a positive step in establishing dignity, inclusion, and respect for all people with intellectual disabilities. And it's representative of some of the other advancements that we are working towards. One example of that is employment first and ensuring that more opportunities are available to people with disabilities to be fully accepted in the mainstream of our community and to work and to be as independent as possible. And I think the last story that you had on that talked about people with visual disabilities and their right to work speaks to that as well.
Barbara, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Barbara Beckert is Milwaukee Office Director and the Director of External Advocacy for Southeastern Wisconsin for Disability Rights Wisconsin. Up next, it's news. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. We're going to Superior now to look at the Lake Superior Fishing Agreement on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The fishing agreement sets harvest quotas on lake trout, among other things, and the DNR, along with the Red Cliff and Bad River bands of Lake Superior Chippewa, have been working on a new agreement. Are you a sports angler? What questions do you have about the Lake Superior Fishing Agreement? Call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior and the host of the regional program Hear Me Out. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
So you recently reported on how some anglers aren't happy with how the Lake Superior Fishing Agreement was reached. Before we dig into concerns, can you tell us what this agreement is all about? What does it do?
Yeah, so the tribes and the state jointly manage the fishery. And for the tribes, they were guaranteed the right to hunt, fish, and gather under treaties with the federal government. So this agreement is part of maintaining those rights and the resource in Lake Superior.
And so what are some of the finer points of this agreement? Like, what does it say?
Yeah, the agreement defines the amount of lake trout that are available in the Wisconsin waters of Lake Superior, around the Apostle Islands and the Twin Ports. And it applies to how gear and netting are used. It defines things like which areas are open or restricted to state commercial and tribal commercial fishermen, and monitoring and reporting requirements, things like that.
Is there also dates, like when an area is open for fishing and when it's not?
Yes, thank you. It does apply to things like season dates for lake trout, whitefish, and cisco. And fishing gear standards and things like that.
And so there's been some working on this agreement for some time now, because there was an original agreement dating back to 2005?
Yeah, so the last agreement, which was in place for 10 years, expired in 2015. And the state and tribes began negotiating a new agreement in 4 years ago, 2014. So this has been a very long process, and I think one can infer from that obviously it's been pretty difficult to reach agreements on the finer points of things, because if it was easy, it probably wouldn't have lasted for the last 4 years.
And so hammering out this agreement, this is done in private or behind closed doors?
So the negotiations between the state and tribes have been largely confidential. And, I haven't been able to talk to either the tribes or the DNR about why that is. They've been pretty tight-lipped about portions of the agreement, preferring to send out statements about what they've accomplished. Just kind of reading the tea leaves, part of the reason for that is that the relationship between the state and the tribes hasn't always been the greatest. It's been pretty tenuous at times on not only this issue, but others relating to, you know, how wildlife are managed or things like the wolf hunt. You know, I mean, there's just hasn't always been they haven't always seen eye to eye on how the resource should be managed, and that would extend to even like chronic wasting disease.
And now some anglers aren't happy with how this all went down. And let's dial in first on the concern about whitefish. We have some audio from your reporting from Scott Breading here. What he's had to say about a new October season for commercial fishing of whitefish for a period of 5 years. That's part of the agreement.
That could devastate that fishery in a short period of time. And they have no quotas or any data of what they want to target for amount of take.
So, Danny, what has the DNR said about whitefish?
So they're saying that, you know, this is something where all year round, the whitefish season is open to sports anglers. And so for this season, it would be an experiment that they would try, and it would be continually assessed. And that they don't think it will harm the fishery. And it would only be open to commercial fishermen that don't have all, like, that have leftover lake trout tags. Because whenever you are given tags, whether you mean to catch lake trout or not, they have to be tagged and retained. So, because sometimes you will catch other fish that you're out fishing for in the lake. So they're saying that this wouldn't have much of an impact, that they would only allow large mesh gill nets to be used. And, you know, sometimes the type of gear that is used out in the lake has been a point of contention between the tribes and sports anglers. They have differing views on that.
So besides this, what other concerns do some anglers have?
Well, you know, you heard from Scott Breading, and one of the things that he said is that they were concerned that, you know, they didn't have any data to base this on. They're also fearful that it puts more pressure on the fishery with the netting that would be used, you know, that even if they would be out fishing for whitefish, that they might end up taking a lot more lake trout incidentally. In doing that, they were also concerned about impacts to spawning areas for fish, and say it pushes anglers further out into the lake. So that was some of their concerns about this new agreement and the fact that they weren't able to have a seat at the table. And the DNR is supposed to be representing both the state commercial fishermen and sports anglers in this. And the DNR, for their part, says, you know, this is something that will be benefiting sports anglers. They'll get more lake trout out of this agreement. You know, the vast majority of the areas that are open to sports anglers have been maintained. So they think that they were able to achieve a balance between the wants and needs of every party in the agreement.
We're talking with Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior. There's a line for you to join us. Are you an angler who fishes on Lake Superior? What is your reaction to the latest fishing agreement? Do you like the plan, or do you feel like you didn't get a say? 800-642-1234. Are you a member of one of the tribes involved in negotiating the agreement? What does the outcome of the agreement mean for you and for Lake Superior? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Danny, when you put the old agreement from 2005 and the new agreement side by side, do you see any major differences?
Not really. I mean, a large portion of the agreement has been maintained. Like, if you look at the lake trout quota or the goal that they set for the lake trout harvest, that's largely the same. They have made minor adjustments to how much can be harvested around the Apostle Islands and around the Twin Ports. A lot of the adjustments in this agreement have been made to information sharing and monitoring and reporting among the state and tribes. You know, one of the things that changed is that there will have to be enhanced marking for tribes on home use nets, which are different than the tribal commercial fishing nets. So there's just, you know, smaller things, like the bigger things, like the fishing refuges that are restricted to commercial anglers or commercial fishermen, that has been maintained. So I think more or less it's anytime you have differing viewpoints, there's going to be some people that walk away from negotiations and aren't quite happy with it. And I think that's why it took probably 4 years to come to the place where we're at right now.
What about the Red Cliff and Bad River bands of Lake Superior Chippewa? How have they responded to it all?
You know, the tribes haven't said much regarding this process, you know, much like the state. They're being very tight-lipped about it. I reached out to Bad River, and they declined to comment at all on the agreement. At Red Cliff, they put out, they have a weekly newsletter, and they kind of laid out the agreement for their members about what it would maintain and what it would change. And their tribal chairman, Rick Peterson, has said that they think that this preserves and protects treaty rights and the resource in the lake. So for their part, they seem to be happy with the agreement that was reached.
Are there any rumblings about a potential lawsuit on this? What do we know about any legal action?
Yeah, so last week when the Natural Resources Board met, they met in closed session to discuss potential litigation surrounding their pending approval of rules that would basically put this agreement into practice. They did not take any action coming out of that closed session regarding that. And it's not really clear if there would be litigation due to the finer points of the agreement or the fact that the Natural Resources Board hasn't approved the rule to put the agreement in practice, because it's been signed by the DNR secretary and the tribes. So there could potentially be a conflict there between an agreement that's been reached and administrative codes to put that in place. And as far as the sports anglers go, they are researching the legality of that agreement. And when I asked Scott Breading about whether or not they would consider, you know, suing the state or the tribes or, you know, filing a lawsuit, they said there's nothing that's off the table. So it's been a contentious issue for sure.
And I would assume that you'll be watching for the next step of any potential lawsuits to roll out of this.
Yeah, I mean, if the Natural Resources Board doesn't act, I mean, they're supposed to act in the coming months to either put this the rules in place or not. And so it remains to be seen what'll happen with that.
Talking with Danielle Kading, she is WPR's reporter in Superior. You can keep your questions coming about the Lake Superior Fishing Agreement at 800-642-1234. Meanwhile, we're going to look at another issue being monitored by the DNR involving manure spreading requirements in eastern Wisconsin. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The DNR is working with counties and farms in eastern Wisconsin to enforce new restrictions on manure spreading that took effect last year. The new rules limit how much manure is spread on farms across 16 counties. Eastern Wisconsin residents, we want to hear from you. Are you happy with the new restrictions being implemented? Do you think they'll have a positive impact on groundwater in the area? Are they easing your concerns about contaminated water? And farmers, are these too restrictive? Are they causing you any financial challenges, or are they appropriate? Share your experience at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. WPR's reporter Danielle Kading stays with us, and she's been covering this. So, Danny, the Natural Resources Board got a check-in about new standards last week when it comes to manure spreading, and these standards went into place last year. Can you help us, remind us what these do?
Yeah, the new performance standards for farmers in that area, it limits how much manure can be spread. Farms with less than 2 feet of topsoil can't spread there because it's likely that anything on the landscape there would seep down into the groundwater below, and that could potentially cause contamination. So they're unable to do that, and that's being implemented, like you said, across the 16-county area there, and it applies to both large and small farms.
Oh, so both CAFOs and smaller farms have to comply with this. How does that play into the permitting process required for concentrated animal feeding operations?
Yeah, so as these standards are put in place, these concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, will have to meet them. But they are meeting them right now as permits are being reissued for their facilities, and that happens on a 5-year cycle. So it's possible that some CAFOs might not meet the standards until, 5 years out if they were permitted as recently as last year. But that's unlikely, according to county conservation staff that I've talked with, that they are already taking steps to come into compliance with the standard. And it's still early yet. You know, how these standards are being put in place are still being developed by the Wisconsin Department of Ag, or DATCAP. So there's a lot that still has to be worked out with meeting these requirements so that there's more protection of groundwater and water quality in the area.
Who is in charge of making sure these restrictions are being implemented, that they're being carried out on the farms?
Yeah, so the DNR sets the kind of the what of the standards and what has to be met, but the Department of Ag changes the rules to develop the best practices for farmers to put in place, and then the DNR enforces whether or not those standards are met.
Do we know that that is going on? Does the DNR have enough agents to get out on these farms and check in on them?
So at the meeting last week, Brian Weigel, who is with the runoff management program at the DNR, said that they do think that they have sufficient staff to oversee permitting of current operations. And again, that would be the larger farms right now. But he did say that the budget didn't account for enforcement of those standards in the last fiscal year. And now as we're heading into the next budget cycle, there's an opportunity for the state there to increase, whether it's enforcement funding or other methods, because farm groups like the Dairy Business Association have said that they'd like to see funding for county conservation staff or cost sharing for farmers to implement these rules. So I imagine that that would be something that would be discussed as we're going through the next budget process.
We're talking with Danielle Kading. She is WPR's reporter who is based in Superior. We're looking at new restrictions brought on last year on manure spreading. The new rules limit how much manure is spread on farms across 16 counties. Danny, what is next for the DNR on improving this process? Is there any type of, plan to bring in perhaps a groundwater testing as part of this?
Yeah, so that's exactly what the Natural Resources Board wanted to know when they requested this update. They wanted to know, whether or not the DNR had sufficient resources to be able to implement them, and also how they're going to ensure that the standards that have been put in place are actually going to address the issues with water quality concerns in that area. And part of that, with that, they want to see baseline data on the groundwater quality in that region. And there has been a study that was conducted. The DNR asked for that in, I think it was 2015, to find types of sources of contamination within wells in the Kewaunee County area. And so they sampled more than 300 wells as part of that in 2015. And as part of that study, they found that there were 60% of wells that were tested had signs of waste from cows and people. So I think the
60%?
60% had signs of waste from cows and people. So the Natural Resources Board is saying they want to know what that data is, and that they'd like to see that information repeated or that study conducted again, to know whether or not the changes that are being made now on farms are having any impact in what they're seeing in people's water quality.
Right. So replicate to see if you get these same numbers in the end. They want to test more to make sure that they're arriving at the right conclusions.
Yeah. I mean, because one would think that if these standards work, that those numbers would go down. So there's definitely a desire there to have more science to back up whether or not the practices being put in place are successful.
Do we have a sense that following these restrictions is affordable? Is it doable for farmers?
The thing I keep hearing over and over again from the DNR and from farm groups is that there should be cost sharing for this for farmers and for county conservation staff, especially with concerns right now with the dairy market in Wisconsin. It's no secret that farmers are really struggling with a myriad of challenges that they're facing, whether it's milk prices or equipment, rising equipment prices, the trade landscape. You know, it's just a really tough time for smaller farmers right now. And so asking them to take steps that might cost money to implement these standards could be burdensome for them, so they'd like to see assistance from the state for that. But Bill Bruins, who's on the Natural Resources Board, thought that he didn't think this would be burdensome for farmers as long as there's cooperation between all parties working on this.
And this is confined to the eastern part of the state now. Will it spread elsewhere in the state, and what might that rollout look like?
Well, that was definitely the hope of the board, that when they put these standards in place, that the information that they would learn from this process could be used to inform practices in other areas of the state where we might be seeing similar concerns. Like, we've seen tests come out now of groundwater or water quality in southern Wisconsin, who has had similar issues with their soil and bedrock that is contributing to water quality concerns. So I think there's definitely a hope that we're nudging the needle forward on addressing the state's water quality concerns.
In the last few seconds, has DNR Secretary Preston Cole weighed in on this?
Yes, he said to the board that they should be excited because Governor Evers has made water quality a top priority. He mentioned it in his State of the State address. And so he said that he would be meeting with the new Ag Secretary to talk about the standards and ways to implement them and protect water quality in Wisconsin.
Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior and the host of the regional program Hear Me Out. She joined us to detail some of the issues the State Department of Natural Resources is working on. Just ahead, we consider the future of the state's economy, and we look at the government shutdown and the effects of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.